This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to begin our show today talking about women in power and about one glass ceiling that has been shattered. This week, the political science majors at Wellesley College welcomed one of their most famous alumna.
Madeleine Albright, Wellesley class of 1959, became the country's first female Secretary of State in 1997. Now, with regard to that glass ceiling that you mentioned, Meghna, political science professor Craig Murphy said it was made of gorilla glass, but that Albright was able to crash through it in part because of networks of people who supported her.
Secretary Albright, I want to introduce you to the latest members of one of those networks, the political science majors of Wellesley College.
Very good. Great. Thank you very much.
Albright came to talk foreign policy with student fellows at the Madeleine K. Albright Institute for Global Affairs, which she helped establish here at Wellesley. She told these poli-sci majors they're in pretty rare company, given that two of the three women who've served as Secretary of State are Wellesley graduates.
What has happened since, my youngest, I love to tell the story, my youngest granddaughter, when she turned seven a couple of years ago, said, so what's the big deal about Grandma Maddie being Secretary of State? Only girls are Secretary of State. And in her lifetime, that would be true.
It would be true indeed. After Albright, the list includes Condoleezza Rice and the current Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. We had a chance to sit down with Madeleine Albright to talk about her work as Secretary of State. We started off talking about women's rights and how she tried to put them at the center of U.S. foreign policy.
I obviously am a feminist, but the bottom line is that if you look at societies, they are much more stable if women are involved. And as somebody who was responsible for America's position in the world and our security, you obviously want your country to exist within a framework where other societies are more stable. And we do know that when women are involved, both politically and economically, that the societies operate better. And if many countries, most countries, women are more than half the population. So it's not using a very basic human resource in order to capitalize on the fact that women are prepared to work very hard.
Which I think is related to this next question, the importance of empowering, educating women around the world. To what extent are women's rights the key to resolving other issues around the world? I mean, women's rights in and of themselves, obviously very important, but it seems like once you empower and educate women around the world, you're going to be solving a whole host of other challenges around the globe.
Well, there are different aspects to it. One thing that I've said is that Afghanistan was a case in point, is that if women are not treated properly, it is a sign of what might happen to other people, to men. And so women are in some ways are the canary in the coal mine, which is showing, in fact, that there is no respect for human dignity or the role of the individual. And so there is that aspect to it. Secretary Clinton said this when she was First Lady at the Women's Conference in Beijing, and it was just astounding, simple phrase, but astounding. Women's rights are human rights, and human rights are women's rights. And making it very clear that this was central to the way a society treats its people.
Mm. How are we doing now? I mean, the narrative of women's rights, how it's progressing, what's your feeling about that now?
I think it's improving, but it's mixed. But what I find interesting is there has been a step forward in many countries in terms of the number of women heads of state and women in their parliaments. When I was Secretary of State, there were 14 other women foreign ministers. I think now there are more than 600 women ministers throughout the world of various portfolios, and there are certainly more women that are running countries.
Well, let me ask you about that. I did a little research on this last night. I think it's 20 countries around the world either have female prime ministers or female presidents. You are the first female Secretary of State in this country. We still have not elected a female president. Why not? I mean, countries from Australia to Thailand, Finland to Argentina have women presidents or prime ministers, not the United States. Why not?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a very interesting question, and the answer is I don't know. But I do think that it is very important to support women at all levels of public service and government, because what you have to do is to create a bench, is to make clear that there are capable, qualified women. But it's to me, passing strange that we haven't been able to do that.
Let me ask you about your experience at the UN, where you served as U.S. ambassador. When you arrived there, there were very few women permanent representatives. How many were there, and what struck you about that when you got there?
Well, I tell you what was interesting. At the time that I got there, there were 183 countries at the UN, and I had an assistant, and I said, could you please invite all the women permanent representatives to my residence? And so I get there, and there's six other women there out of 183. And the countries were Canada, Philippines, Kazakhstan, Trinidad, Tobago, Jamaica, Liechtenstein, and me.
Interesting group.
Interesting group. So being an American, I decided we had to form a caucus. And so I called it the G7. We made certain pledges to each other. One was that we would always take each other's telephone calls. And what really did happen was a male permanent representative from a large country said, so why are you taking calls from the ambassador from Liechtenstein and not me? And I said, well, you've got a choice here. You can have yourself traded for a woman. You know, so they stopped asking that. But the bottom line was we did manage to be quite effective, even at that number, because one of the issues that was out there was the creation of the War Crimes Tribunal on the former Yugoslavia when we first started. And since most of the crimes have been committed against women, rape, and so we lobbied in order to get women judges on the War Crimes Tribunal, and we did manage. We got two, one of them an American.
I know that, that was a great story about how it was still so much a men's club when you were there. And speaking of that, what was it like to sit down at your first UN Security Council meeting? 15 members, 14 men, and you, right?
Well, it's very interesting. We've all gone to many meetings that are men and women, and mostly just one woman at the table. You want to say something, and you think, well, that's going to sound stupid. So you don't say it, and then some man says it, and everybody thinks it's brilliant. Hmm. And you're really mad at yourself for not having said it. But it's one of those things that you have to make yourself say something, because otherwise it doesn't happen. So having told people that and my students and everything, I end up at the UN, and the first day in an informal room where the members of the Security Council come to discuss issues, and I look around, and there are 14 men from different places all looking at me like this, and I thought to myself, well, I'll just wait to see what it's like and if they like me and if they'll listen to me. And all of a sudden, I looked at the sign that said the United States. And I said, if I don't speak today, then the voice of the United States will not be heard. And so I kind of overcame, even at my age, this kind of sense that I would wait to see what people thought about me before I expressed my views. But it was a lesson. It really was.
Mm. Any sense that day of how the other folks responded to you? I mean, did they hear you as the voice of the United States or the woman representative of the United States?
No, what's interesting is I was not the first woman ambassador.
Of course, Jean Kirkpatrick
had been. This was more my internal problem. What was interesting was when I was named, or my name came up to be Secretary of State, there were those who said there was no way a woman could be Secretary of State, mainly because of Arab paternal authoritarian systems, etc. What happened that was interesting was that the Arab ambassadors at the UN got together and actually said, we've had no problem dealing with Ambassador Albright. Our countries will not have trouble dealing with Secretary Albright. So that issue went away. The truth is, I say this as a joke, but in some extent it's true, is I did not have problems abroad. I arrived in a very large plane that said United States of America. They knew that if they were going to negotiate, they would have to talk to me. In many ways, I had more problems with the men in our own government.
Interesting.
And not because they were male chauvinist pigs, but because they, in fact, had seen me go through a very long climb in my career. I had been a carpool mother and a friend of their wives or on a board. I had been a staffer on Capitol Hill. I had made a lot of coffee and had done a lot of Xeroxing. And all of a sudden, there I am. And they thought, well, why is she Secretary of State instead of me?
Well, I'm interested to hear you talk about it. The challenge was dealing with folks in this country, in this government. But I have to ask this. How difficult was it when you were Secretary of State to bring up the issue of women's rights, of empowering women in countries where traditions discourage those kinds of conversations. I'm just curious how you approach that.
Well, I think, first of all, one of the things that's difficult as Secretary of State is you're sitting across a table from somebody and you have to bring up the issues that matter to your country. And it is not easy to go and smile and say, you have to do something about human rights. But I do think what did happen, frankly, on my first trip, this issue as to whether a woman could deal with Arabs, I did arrive for a meeting of the Gulf Cooperation Council, which were all the Arab ambassadors in the Middle East, and they it was a great meeting, and at the end of it I said, perhaps you haven't noticed, but I'm dressed differently than my predecessors, and next time we'll talk about women's rights. And what was very interesting was we did it. A lot of the ministers then made it a point when I came back to talk about women's rights, to introduce me to their wives and daughters. But it is not easy ever to go into a country and criticize them or raise issues. And I used to have a trick, which was after the small talk, I'd say, I have come a long way, so I must be frank. And then we talk about it.
Was there an advantage to being a woman diplomat that you could bring to those conversations as a woman?
I actually think there were advantages. First of all, I think that, I did invent the art of diplomatic kissing, which was very complicated because every country has a somewhat different style. The Latins, some kiss on the right cheek, some kiss on the left cheek. I never could remember which was which.
You mean they start on one cheek and then end on the other?
Well, no, you actually want just one kiss, but you did. So a lot of bump noses. And then the French, who kiss on both cheeks, and the Dutch on three times. And I mean, it was very complicated. And Yasser Arafat, that was just really complicated.
Because how did he kiss?
All over the place. Very indiscriminate. And you can visualize that he and I were kind of the same height, but when he tried it on President Clinton, it was... But I do think that what makes, I think, a good negotiator is somebody who can put him, herself, into the other person's shoes. That is the really important part in order to understand what the other person is trying to do. And I think women are very good at that. I do think women make good diplomats, and we certainly have had a lot of good ones.
I know our time is limited. I just have one more question, and this is just a question that gets to what life is like to a former Secretary of State. And I heard this great anecdote about a dinner party that you had, I don't know if it was months ago or years ago, with all the living former Secretaries of State. And I just love that scene, and I want to ask you what it was like, because there you are, Henry Kissinger, Democrats, Republicans, all together.
I tell you, it was amazing. What did happen was that this was something that Secretary Schultz started, and so we were at my house, and sitting in my dining room, Secretary Kissinger and Schultz and Powell and Larry Eagleburger and Secretary Christopher, and I think we are bonded by this idea of being in that office and dealing with really difficult problems and not second-guessing as much as trying to be helpful. There were no sense of partisanship, but more of trying to help and making clear that we understood how difficult it was. It's a very small club, but we are friends. We are all friends, but it was amazing. I have to tell this, when I became secretary, Henry Kissinger called me up, and he said, you know, Madeline, you have, in fact, taken a one distinction away that I have of being a foreign-born Secretary of State. And I said, no, Henry, I don't have an accent. And then he introduced me at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he said, welcome to the fraternity. And I said, it's not a fraternity anymore. And so watching the around my table with Condoleezza Rice and Hillary and me in that group, was also something that was very thrilling.
Well, Secretary Madeleine Albright, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. We spoke to her yesterday at Wellesley College, where she helped establish the Madeleine Corbell Albright Institute for Global Affairs. And you can comment on what you just heard at radioboston.org.
And speaking of comments, we'll share some of yours on Bruins goalie Tim Thomas. That plus our weekend picks. That's all coming up next. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.